Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking healthcare. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and former child actor, I'm led to believe, Martin.
Yeah. I don't think there was TV around when I was a child.
Someone
Tony.
Said to me you were one of the Milky Bar kids. You did say you were blonde before.
No, I used to have hair, Tony, but I wasn't blonde. And now you make me feel bad about not having hair again.
Welcome back. Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by GP and lecturer in general practice at the Royal College of Surgeons Ireland, Dr. Mark Murphy. Mark, how are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for inviting me on. It's a real pleasure to be on the podcast. Thanks very much.
That's great. Thanks for coming in to see us, Mark.
I'm going to kick us straight off, Mark. We saw during the week, 2 days ago, actually, the Independent Review Group came out with a panel of recommendations, and there was a really fascinating quote, at least I thought it was fascinating, where they said, Donald the Butler, who launched the report, said, I'm a real optimist, but I'm also a giant pragmatist. When he was asked the question, what did he think of the recommendations or the plans would unfold? You might want to could you give listeners an idea of what that idea of the independent review group and what they were talking about in terms of decoupling, I want to say, private healthcare from public services?
Yeah. I think a useful place to start is to just take one step backwards and think of the big picture. So we've had repeated health reforms and policy papers and they've never been implemented. We know that there are multiple problems in Ireland. We've over half the population have to access the free market for general practice and primary care. That's obscene. It's not good enough. We know that we have excellent public healthcare services, but there's an issue with access because we don't really understand and we haven't appropriately regulated the public-private interface. And we know that private markets are very poor at allocating resources and meeting the demand for healthcare with supply. So there's major issues with equity and fairness and access. So we know that there are waiting lists. So how are we going to get around this? And in fairness to the Social Democrats and Roisin Shortall and a variety of other actors, particularly of parties of the left, I'm in the Labour Party, but this was a cross-party consensus. We came together under the stewardship of a GP, Michael Harty, who is chairing this committee. We came up with Sláintecare. And that word in itself is not the solution. It's what's behind it. It was a vision. It was a value system that it's not good enough, that we're going to make some hard choices. It also compromised crucially on the fact that we are absolutely okay with private healthcare taking place in secondary care hospitals. That's okay, but just not within our public hospitals. So what Sláintecare did was really twofold. Within a phased basis, we're going to increase access to primary care and general practice. That is the norm in every other OECD country. And we can definitely do that. And I can talk about that. But the controversial issue was, let's try and make access within our publicly owned secondary care hospitals, within St. Vincent's Hospital, the Mater Hospital, Mallow, Cork, Limerick. When someone walks in that door, is there going to be a ward that is for private patients? And is there going to be the rest of the hospital for public patients? And I think the world of every healthcare professional, particularly consultant colleagues, and my best friends are consultant colleagues, but we cannot doubt that there is a difficulty here. There is an incentivization. When someone walks in there and you have 50 patients, which patients are you going to see? Are you going to see the 5 patients that are in the private ward? Are you going to see the 45 patients that are scattered throughout when you already work in 90-hour weeks? And is that fair for those patients? Are the sickest patients being seen? Maybe put it in another view. Let's just say you've 2 theatres and you have surgeons in the 2 theatres and one theatre has 3 public patients that are going to get operated on and the other theatre has 2 private patients and a public patient. If I was an anaesthetist, which room would I rather work in, knowing that I could double my income that day by working in one of the rooms? What's that do to the behaviours, the psychology, the management, the conflicts of interest that erode I suppose, efficient care, about calling out issues to do with quality and safety? So fundamentally, it's just about fairness. It's about equity and it's about fairness, that there are not groups of patients within our public hospitals that are disproportionately benefited. And this is undoubtedly the controversial issue in Sláinte Care. So consultants will be able to work in private hospitals in different sites, absolutely not co-located. What an horrendous ideology that was. And we're still getting over that. So I think this is a very fair and proportionate report. We've been waiting for it. The number was expected. It is exactly what we thought it would be. And the author of the report stated that there's a political choice. Mm. We can pay for high quality, fair public care, and that will come at a cost. And I think as a society, it was his recommendation, his report's recommendation, that as a society, we should make that choice. And consultants will be fairly paid. The working environments in hospital will be better. Crucially for the patient and for the taxpayer and us as the key stakeholder, you know when you're going into public hospital, it's going to be fairer care within that public hospital. There are obviously other issues. We have to increase capacity. We gutted the bed numbers throughout austerity. It's a fallacy to think that we can get, you know, continue and reform healthcare without increasing bed numbers. It's ridiculous that we have unfair pay from that 2012 James Riley cut. That is obscene. It's absolutely affecting recruitment retention. So all those things, this is not a binary choice. It's complicated. But the Butler report is exactly what we thought it would be. It's recommended. And what is crucially telling is that in the week that's followed, we have these stories coming out. Pascal O'Donoghue, really worried about, you know, we need to curtail costs. Mm. We already had the budget last year.
He's called in Minister Harris to talk about his budgets and, you know.
Yeah.
These stories are coming out, you're right.
They are. And okay, so we have Sláinte Care. We agreed it. But now we're actually seeing there's a fracturing. Who is actually for this now? And I think, you know, I know on this podcast, you're always talking about housing, you're talking about education, you're talking about fairness. We have to make the next election. And I'm not going to single out the party I support. This is owned by every political party. And if a political party shirks their responsibility to get behind this report, a reckoning needs to happen. It is a once in a, more than a generation chance to get behind a value system, a belief system, a strategy. And this is it. We have it in our hands. And I think, I'm calling it out. The word vested interests are thrown around. I'm a vested interest. I'm a GP. I make money in this practice. It's okay. I'm a vested interest. Your vested interest, your patients. But we have unions and organizations, the Private Hospital Association coming out and saying certain things. And that's not unexpected. They are vested interests. Mm. And we should call that out. And I would really like when they speak on the media that those conflicts of interest are absolutely prodded and explored. And I think that's an issue in the media too, because we just let sometimes, a really interesting press release came out. Well, you know, no surprise it came out. And I think we need all this to kind of come out. I mean, Sláinte Care is, it has to be owned. It has to be shaped. Stakeholders, their voice has to be owned. But I think the big issue is communication. And I suppose that's what I'm doing here. And that's what you're doing. Mm. We have to communicate why it's so important and why the Butler report. It was spun as some sort of negative, difficult issue. It's not. This is the issue in Sláinte Care that had to be teased out. We're teasing it out. We have a budget coming up. We have an election coming. Let's get behind it. And I think that's the narrative that was kind of missed a little bit in some of the mainstream media.
Now, from my understanding of it, the private element has to be phased out over 10 years. And the cost that's been put on that is approximately 650 million. 10 years seems a very long timeline to phase this. And of course, they're going to have to renegotiate contracts and new contracts for consultants will have to come on that. At the present moment, over a quarter of elective surgeries that are done in public hospitals are done on private patients in public hospitals. Mm. And you can see then why the queues just keep getting longer and longer and longer. If public patients aren't getting the access to elective surgeries, the lists are going to get longer.
Yeah.
So the aim is to take that element out, free capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you can start getting faster throughput.
Yeah.
It makes eminent sense. It just makes, and it's kind of the same across Europe. We have 50-odd% people have private healthcare, whereas the European average is in around 11-12%. And we're four times more people in private healthcare than our European counterparts.
So, we have to qualify this. there's nothing wrong with having private health insurance in Ireland. 50% of the population has it. Half the patients I see have private health insurance. There's nothing wrong with going to a private hospital. Half of people in Ireland do that. My friends and colleagues work in private hospitals. They are excellent. But let's cut to the chase. I don't have private health insurance. I don't because I'm a little bit pious and I sleep better at night for not having it. I just find it hard when the first patient I see waits 3 years and the next patient waits 2 weeks. So I don't have private health insurance. But a lot of people on the street that I live on have private health insurance. There's someone who lives across the road. He's 34. And he came over for a cup of tea. He's like, Mark, what should I do? Should I take out private health insurance or not? Because I'm going to be 35 next year. Mm. He's a young, healthy man. Like the other issues we talk about, you know, about the cost of living in Dublin, about housing. He's struggling, you know, two persons working, creche fees. And let's just call a spade what happened. Leo Varadkar, several years ago, one of his finest achievements, he said, when he was Minister for Health, was community rating. So what he's done with this, he's imposed another levy on this person, and they've taken out private health insurance. They're giving that money to a for-profit insurance company, and he gets nothing back for that. Gets nothing back for that at the moment. That private health insurance company, I think it's disproportionately regulated. We don't know what they cover. They don't cover general practice. They don't cover mental health. You know, they cover kind of lucrative procedures and little bits and bobs they want, or a wellness campaign, or some sort of video corporate thing. Like
free and, Fitbit.
Yeah, exactly. And okay, so there's an issue. I mean, that's the black hole in medicine right there, that we have forced an already like squeezed middle class into paying out extra more money when actually we don't need it. What that person really needs is access to primary care general practice that can be funded by the state, and a phased increase in capacity in secondary care. And they don't need health insurance at all. And health insurance then will be an optional extra. That is absolutely valid. And there'll be private hospitals that can be used for that. But we have forced and we've used fear and the negativity in the headlines around public health. It feeds into this narrative that we must get that. I don't have private health insurance. I don't need it. I have a GP. In time, it would be great if I didn't have to pay that person. I think that can happen. And I go to wonderful public hospitals in Ireland and I don't need it. And I think that's the narrative and that's the value system behind Sláintecare. Inevitably that will happen.
Well, you know, as somebody who's been in and out of them for quite a few years, I can say about hospitals that I end up sitting with public, private patients. Mm. All get the same treatment. Mm-hmm. We all get the same treatment. Now, how fast you get that treatment differs.
Yeah.
But the level of care once you're in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And I hear people say it all the time. Once you're in the system, the level of care is great. Yes, it is. It is good, but your access to that system is dependent upon having private health insurance. You get to see a consultant way, way faster. And that's the bottom line. You see your consultant quicker.
I mean, all other social democracies have sorted this out. And arguably, we're not really an appropriate social democracy with what happens.
We're not a social
democracy. We're not. I mean, if you look at health and education and I suppose it goes back to the fundamental. And housing, they're the big three issues. I mean, you have an asymmetry between supply and demand in medicine. Okay. And this is the ultimate issue. This debate has been won over 30, 40 years ago in every other country, that the market does not equitably, the demand for healthcare is not met with supply. You rise supply, demand rises. So you need to regulate healthcare markets appropriately so that inequalities do not happen. So on one hand, we have unmet need that healthcare meets that demand. And on the other hand, you have an oversupply of healthcare that has no evidence base. And I think within this mix is advertising, and within this mix is evidence. So as a doctor, I have to provide therapies that have an evidence base, diagnostic tests that have an evidence base. And actually what's happening in the market of healthcare, and we hear this, I was driving over here, I heard an ad for a nearby private hospital. Come to us, consume. And this is all about the commodification of healthcare, about too much medicine, over medicalization, and this is all in the mix at the moment. And when we talk about healthcare in Ireland and rising costs, actually public healthcare has definitely gone up each year, and about 40% of that is due to the aging population. So we have to tackle that. There are issues in civil service and the public services that we have to address in terms of governance. But most of the increase in expenditure is private. It's ballooning. It is a free market. I want, I consume, I get MRIs, tests, come back.
NCT.
Oh, this is the problem with medicine. And it's an endemic in private healthcare. It's also endemic in my practice. I'm not pointing the finger. It's an issue everywhere. There's too much of what's happening. And we have to meet demand, unmet demand. But what's the paradox in healthcare is that we're doing too much on healthy people and we're harming everyone. So, I mean, going back to private healthcare, I mean, they talk about how we have to subsidize public hospitals. It's a reverse subsidy that's happening. So what happens is that private hospitals are closed for double digit days over Christmas. What happens is that they do lucrative elective procedures. They don't look after people who have, you know, a severe stroke, that have, you know, multiple psychological and social needs. They look after things that are profitable and more power to them. And the market needs to be regulated to manage that. But what is the cost of that? Because people think they're getting a service. They're paying into the private health insurance. But when they're actually sick, they go to the public hospital. We need a reverse subsidy. A reverse subsidy. And that's actually what's going to happen with the Butler report. And it's appropriate and it's about time.
Well, when you factor that in, funnily enough, we had your party colleague, Anthony O'Connor, gastroenterologist, in, and he spoke about over Christmas in the public service, coming in to make emergency procedures to carry out emergency works, and getting home to see the kids opening the Christmas presents, and then going back to visit it was a powerful moment, because he spoke about it in such terms of someone who clearly, what I like to call the give a shit factor, right? And he clearly, that came right through. But what I suppose I would counter that, and I have to counter it with, is the fact that people say, well, outside of America, we have the highest funded health service, you know, all of this money per capita. For sure. And they will tell you that it's, you know, we'll have the argument then that it's, you know, it's civil servants, it's too many layers of management, and there's too much bureaucracy. I suppose you've dealt with that when you said that the growing... we're getting older. Therefore, if you're living longer and you're getting older, you're going to... But within Sláinte Care, and the other concern of Sláinte Care is that, Martin, you point of 650 million to
implement... Well, that's what they that's the cost that has been put out, or the news cost that has been put out on phasing out the private out of the public hospitals. But as you said, it's actually a gain. That figure, that 650 million figure, that's kind of a scare tactic. There's actually a gain to the public service for getting rid of the private and increasing your capacity. That's where your real gain comes, is when you're able to increase your capacity.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, that we do a good enough job, and you mentioned the media, do we do a good enough job actually pushing back on those narratives?
Absolutely. And it's on doctors like myself to push back. I suppose one of the biggest cognitive deceits that we have as humans, and definitely in medicine, is this rush to binary thinking. You know, like, it's private healthcare is all good or all bad. And like, it's like, this is so complicated, and private is, it's not bad at all. It is, you know, it's within the NHS. I mean, it's a complementary added service. And no market, no healthcare market has found a solution. It's just our balance is particularly poor. I don't think we talk about, the difficulties with public private medicine. Every country is struggling with the proportionality between public and private care, and how we allocate fair resources in an equitable manner. But we don't talk about in Ireland the role of private health insurance. I guarantee you, if you listen to RTE or News Talk tomorrow, if we have a discussion on this issue, they will have a broker from an insurance company talking about what plan you should get from their particular brokerage. That's a conflict of interest. I mean, we have to call these conflicts, you know, you've Mary Harney on boards of, you know, Videodoc at the same time that public general practice is gutted. You've Brendan Drum, he gutted general practice and devised a system in which you'd have public-private partnership owned buildings, and himself and family members are involved in, you know, the ownership of investment companies in those entities. Mm. And I think we have to call out these conflicts of interest. So getting back to public private care and private health insurance, I don't have private health insurance. I don't need it. Is that ever stated? Is that ever stated?
No.
On mainstream media? It's seen, again, I mean, how many persons in the Dáil have private health insurance? Would you say it's 100%?
Oh, I'd say it's 100%.
Yeah. So again, it's about representative democracy.
Yes.
And we have to, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with having private health insurance, but just the balance is all wrong. And that trickles down into our policy decisions and everything we talk about.
I like to talk, well, you mentioned, again, about the media. I can think of one flagship radio show that's sponsored by a private hospital. I can think of several that actually have links to private medicine.
And on the hour, newsflash, major scandal, public healthcare, access, waiting lists. And then sponsored by private health, like get.
Well, I mean, there have been some particularly disturbing ads, you know, where it is portrayed, you shouldn't have to wait in a queue. You should have access. You know, they're the ones that scare me the most. I don't like them. I mean, I'm 10 years stuck in the system with no private health insurance. Mm. I'm still here. I've gotten all the treatments I needed to get. Yeah. I'm still walking around. I'm an advert for public health care.
You don't look at me.
But they have kept me alive, you know.
And I think, I like throwing platitudes towards Anthony O'Connor. We need emotion. And I know you two are emotional fellas. And I am. I can't help it. I get emotional about things. But it's not right. It's not right that over 50% of the population have to pay the market price to access general practice. It's not right that within general practice, like, you wait 2 weeks, you wait 3 years. That's not right. It bothers me. It bothers me so much. I think we have to care. And I think Anthony exudes that emotion and passion. And I think, like, if we don't use that emotion, now, we use quantitative data. We use narratives and qualitative stories. We put context on it. I'll try not to rush to a binary judgment, which I try to. Things aren't all good or all bad, but we have to care. And the beauty of Sláintecare is that it's packaged all that quantitative data, all that qualitative data. It's brought all the policy, all the political parties together, and it's channeled all that anger and emotion into a cogent, tangible solution that we all get behind. Mm. And we have to do it. This is our chance. And the next election is the chance to vote in parties who believe in that strategy.
Going to move us a little towards GP. That's your area. That's where your stomping ground. There is a GP crisis at the moment. And this GP crisis has been ongoing and deepening for a number of years. Mm. Have we hit the wall? Have we hit the point of no return where the services are in terminal decline?
Yeah, I'm conscious. I don't want to speak on behalf of all GPs. I have a few conflicts of interest. I'm involved in my union, the IMO GP committee. I'm not speaking on their behalf. I teach general practice. I work with, like, there's four of us in a new practice we just set up in the South Circular Road. So I'm just speaking on from my own perspective on this one, because there are multiple opinions within general practice. We're quite heterogeneous. But we are a family as well. Undoubtedly, general practice is in difficulty in Ireland. It's in difficulty for a few reasons. First of all, about €1 billion was taken out of general practice in real terms. So in austerity, high earners obviously had to take a proportional hit, you know, and that was, and general practice.
This was in FEMPI.
These are the financial emergency measures that were taken out, repeated cuts on the top line payments from state contracted services to general practice. So that meant and now I see this as a GP, that the incomes that you make from state contracts are income. Then you have expenses, and then after that, you can pay yourself a salary and staff, etc. So if you take 40% off that top line, that's not 40% cut to me. That's the business ruined. That's absolutely, you know, you go from a GP earning a salary to earning nothing. With that's what FEMPI did. And it wasn't just FEMPI. They were particularly mean to rural practices. They took a rural practice allowance out. Why do GPs not want to work in rural Ireland? They took out the rural practice allowance. It was recently reinstated. They took out distance codes. So they took out all this money from general practice. And now, as of this month, 2 weeks ago, the first payment to general practice with restoration of those austerity cuts is happening. So general practice was already in a difficult place. It's going to take time for that major trauma to the market to recover. That's one context. Another context is that we don't have enough GPs. Mm-hmm. So we have fewer GPs than the other European OECD countries. That's a major problem. And we have far too few practice nurses. And we're not doing enough to kind of put in place a resource there. And I think we need to talk to the INMO, et cetera, about how we can support that to happen. So they're real issues. I think the third biggest issue is actually, and again, you know, I don't want to sound conspiratorial here. There was it's an ideological issue. General practice was not at the table for the past 12 to 15 years. The competition, the authority came after general practice. Yes. And there was this idea that we don't, like, and this is my personal belief. And I think there are wonderful people in the Department of Health and HSE now. I've worked with them with the abortions, with the getting that contract over the line, the new GP contract. But there was an ideological belief 10 years ago. The current model of general practice isn't quite right. Do you know what it could do? You know, maybe the state shouldn't be involved in the provision of public care. It's too expensive. Do you know what would be great? If the market just came over and if maybe if this whole, that whole GP, I don't even know what GPs do. Maybe if they were corporatized, you know, just like the states, you've managed care areas. Who knows? There might be a provider come over to you. Maybe insurance companies will just do nothing and see if the market works. And I honestly believe that that was the strategy in primary care. So we had the primary care strategy in 2001. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
And I think it was real laissez-faire. It was real. It was this rubbish. Let's do nothing. And I think it's taken a lot of work. I've been doing a lot of lobbying. A lot of us have. And our union, the Irish Medical Organization, has been doing sterling work. And we have shown, and we've shown the evidence base that you need to engage with us and we need to increase what we have incrementally. We need to stabilize existing general practice and springboard on from there. And that's what's happened. So in fairness, actually, in the past few years, it's been really, really good. The Department of Health and HSE has engaged with the Irish Medical Organization in a really constructive way, but it's still going to take time. So I think, you know, we're reeling from austerity cuts. We still don't have enough staff. And now they do believe in us and we're going to increase our incrementally. And we have Sláinte Care saying that we need to take more work on board. And that's another issue too, I think, about where we go in terms of under 12s and the rest of the
population. I was just going to bring that up. There is now a plan floated to add to the numbers of those who can access free GP care.
Okay. Well,
this is the first time they did it. It was an election stunt, and there's I will always maintain it was just an election stunt for overly worried parents, and that's exactly what it has turned into. The capacity is eaten up. Johnny, 2 years old, has a tiny little temperature, and we're going to eat up a GP's time when Johnny really what Johnny needs is fluids and mom and dad to keep an eye on him.
All righty. Well, okay. I'm going to disagree with you now, Martin. Okay. So maybe you're being provocative deliberately. So I would disagree with most of my GP colleagues on this one. So absolutely, we are on our knees in general practice. Some GPs don't have an appointment for another week, you know, like, so capacity is a major issue. Let's just take a step back. General practice at the moment looks after 40% of the population. In general, they are, of the lowest socioeconomic brackets. They have the highest healthcare needs for a variety of psychosocial reasons, because our health is determined by the social determinants and housing and education, all those issues. It's all linked in politics. So we look after 40%. They see us for free already. The under sixes see us for free already. They're high users of the service. The over 70s see us for free at the moment. So we have a not quite normal perspective about the persons who see us for free. Persons who see us at the whim of the market are someone like me, relatively healthy 38-year-old. How often do I go to the GP? I don't go out that often. So our belief about what is going to happen when we increase capacity and we phase the introduction of free GP card visits to the rest of the population, they're not going to visit us as frequently as the highest users, the under sixes, the 40% who already have it, and the over 70s. So The average private patient sees me twice a year. The average medical card patient sees me six times a year. So if you give over half the population a free GP card, what's going to happen those two visits? Are they going to stay at two? Or are they going to go to six? They're going to go to a number in between the two because they're healthier. And we can model it and we can look at the NHS and we can plan it. And they will see us more often, but that is unmet need. There are patients who cannot afford to see me and wait. And the evidence is pretty clear on that. And I think we have to have an honest discussion. So I think all GPs are in agreement that we can't do this tomorrow. Mm. I definitely know we can't do this tomorrow. If it is going to happen, it has to be phased very slowly. Who's going to pay for the extra room that is needed in a GP practice in Middleton or Clonakilty? Where's the practice nurse going to come from? Where are the GPs going to happen? How is that going to be phased in over 5 to 10 years? And actually, we also need new GP practices like the one we set up. Tell you what, it's a huge risk. Who's going to support them? And I'm afraid the health policy arena here is a little bit rudderless and there's not a lot of leadership in this issue.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I know the first time that it impacted the time between idea and implementation was very quick.
True.
With not a whole lot of consultation that went in between the two times.
I'm going to plug Rachel O'Neill's new podcast, Disturbing the Peace, because you made a very valid point about the person who sits there and won't pay the 60 quid to go to see the doctor, because she spoke to Steve O'Rourke recently, who had a spot on his nose, went into the doctor and he said, look, it's either a cold sore or you might have shingles, we'll treat it. He went home, felt bad for another few days. His wife was away for the weekend, and when she came back, she said, he looked absolutely awful. She said, why didn't you go back to the doctor? He said, oh, it's another 50 quid. When they eventually got him in, the shingles were just approaching his brain and he could have lost his sight. And he was literally caught just in time. But that was the decision he made, that it was like, oh, I'm not going back in because I have a cold sore on my nose.
Oh, I have to say that, at the beginning of my cancer journey was exactly like that.
Yeah, but I think we have to be very honest, though. In the NHS, there are two-week waits to see a GP.
There are.
Boris Johnson comes out like, part of my, well, you only have to wait 2 or 3 weeks to see a GP. That was one of his campaign strategies. I think if we increase capacity too soon, the general practices or patients are already waiting a week for some practices. And we have to listen to GPs, listen to our representative bodies. It has to be done with us. Phase, and we have to increase capacity. It's going to take a little bit of time. What's happened? Primary care and community care is core part of Sláinte care. Well, we've been gutted for 10 years and the policymakers are only listening to us now, and just the austerity cuts have been reversed. We have to be a little bit patient and we have to mind the providers. Just like, the consultants, and you spoke about Anthony going in on Christmas Day and obstetricians working through the nights. We have to care for the nurses and doctors and porters and administrators and managers in our healthcare services. And it's going to take a bit of time. And I think we can do it. And I think we need a bit of pride in the HSE. And I think that's coming. And we need more focus rather than the naysayers about the Butler report. We need a bit more optimism about where things can go.
Do you feel politically that the current government is fully behind Sláinte care?
I think my own opinion is that, the government is made up of Fine Gael politicians, supported by Fianna Fáil, really, at the moment. And I think in the government, I think Fine Gael is a heterogeneous party. Let's call a spade a spade.
Yep.
There's a spectrum in there. And I do think that there are persons that are politically aligned to social democratic parties. But I think there's this spectrum going all the way out to the very conservative values about fiscal prudence, about neoliberal policies, about, health is not socially determined. There's personal responsibility, that the state should not step in. And I think there's a tension within that party. Let's just call a spade. And I think there are some persons in that party that believe in it, but there are absolutely others that I know that do not. I know they don't. And the proof is in the budget. Last year's budget and the next year's budget. Let's see what happens with the budget. And then we'll know if the party is behind it.
Now, I know Tony had brought up that per capita we do spend quite a lot. But that always needs to be caveated with coming off a very, very low base.
Oh, yeah.
It always needs to be caveated. The health service was gutted. So when they're talking about putting money in now, they still haven't... adjusted or compensated or made recompense for the gutting that went on in the health service.
We keep coming back to it, the trinity of health, education and housing. And we see these, I want to put it as disingenuous statistics quoted saying, you know, more houses built than any time in the last decade. Whereas you go, you built 917, mate. But if you picked a year earlier, you'd be 83,000. So, you built less than a quarter. So if you pick a point in time to suit your statistic, absolutely, I agree. But what I would say is, first of all, I'm delighted we had this conversation because I do feel a bit more hopeful. And I agree with you when you say that there's an internal struggle within the government. And it's very important that at the budget, that we see a budget that actually slauncher care is not just appointed an implementation manager. You know, all of these things that they missed every deadline so far. They have missed every deadline so far. Can we see it get on track?
I'm actually really hopeful about this. Laura McGahey is fantastic. She is a great team. They're embedded in the Department of Health, working between the Department of Health and HSE. There are serious operators who are, you know, great managers, great operationalists, and there is a belief in the department that this can happen. But the proof is right now. We're in this space right now, and they need it. They need this budget is going to be key, and like I'm fully behind it. So many healthcare professionals, and consultants, and GPs don't believe the hype or what some reports happened this week. We are behind it. One of the biggest issues that has to happen though is that we have to communicate what health is, where the problems are, what the context is, how the solutions, how we can come back, because it's complicated, not little binary, little sound bites. And I think there's an onus actually on the profession now to try and communicate that, like kind of like town hall meetings. This is an important issue for the next 6 months. And I think this is a space that has to happen. And I think medical professionals rose up in the Eighth Amendment referendum. And I think there's another time now. I think we have to be called for to look through our own personal issues that we have, some of the bitterness that we have, the difficult terms and conditions we've had in the past. Look beyond that. Look through that. Use that as context and springboard on to try and sell a solution that we can get behind.
And GPs, particularly, you are small in number, but your voice is listened to. And it is very much, I remember there was the GP protest outside the Dáil, which is very unusual for GPs to protest. Because you said generally a conservative bunch of people. There can be generally a conservative bunch of people. But every news outlet cut it. Because when GPs talk and when doctors talk, people listen.
Yeah.
They do listen. So I agree with you. It's up to the medical profession to sell the message to ordinary people. It is. And I mean, that might be your GP saying, oh, Sláintecare, you know, you're in senior GP, Sláintecare, don't forget that now. We're coming up, you know, stick behind us on that. And, you know, a little bit of politicization. Don't think it's any real harm. Everything is politics when it comes to it. Everything is politics.
Yeah.
Look, I want to end on the optimistic note. I think that you're right. We need to get a message. If you're going to get it across, you've put it out very well. You laid it out that this makes sense, for the patient. It makes sense for economically and it makes sense for the greater good and down the future. And we're not going to get there overnight. So when you hear this sound bites come back at you, realize that, as you said, it's not binary, that these options are just there. And I want to wish you all the best with the new practice.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I have to say there's too much negativity within our profession. Like, I'm not doing that great financially at the moment to set up a new business. I have to tell you this. I've never been happier professionally. Working in GP is the most, like, it's such a privilege. It's so interesting. You're caring for people with, you know, with difficult mental health issues or in distress. You're caring for people's chronic illnesses. You're vaccinating children. You're like providing sexual reproductive health care and abortion services now in general practice. It's so interesting. You're part of a community. And then those social determinants of health that you can understand, they come real. And it's been such a privilege setting a new practice up with three wonderful colleagues. And I think that there's a lot right with gender practice. And unfortunately, the past 10 years have been very difficult. But there's an onus on us not to be disproportionately negative. Sell going abroad to Australia and Canada. I love the job here. And, it'll take a little bit of time for the business to come right and to set up, but it's been really rewarding. And I think it's very important that future doctors and medical students hear that.
Well, congratulations on that, Mark, and wishing you the very best for the future. Thank you so much for coming in and have a chat to us. Patrons, look, we need more patrons, as many as we can get on board. We are like GPs. The more you get in, the more we can fix. We will fix you. We will turn you out, good people. Come, www.tortoiseshack.ie, log in there and become a patron. Thanks very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.